And it would make Alice's behavioral work on grief look like conjecture instead of science. Donnie looked over his shoulder at me. "Wacko," he mouthed. "And your daughter, Dr. Metcalf? Where was she when you walked in on your wife?"
"Asleep," he said, his voice breaking.
Turning away from us, Metcalf cleared his throat.
"It's blatantly clear that the one place my wife is not is in this study. Which begs the question, why are you still here?"
"Officer Stanhope," Donnie said pleasantly, "why don't you go tell MCU to wrap it up while I ask Dr. Metcalf just a few more questions?" I nodded, deciding that Donnie Boylan was the unluckiest son of a bitch on the police force. Somehow, we'd come to certify a reported death caused by elephant trampling, and instead had uncovered a domestic dispute between a nut job and his wife, one which may or may not have resulted in two missing persons and maybe even a homicide. I started walking toward the area where the crime scene investigators were still cataloging useless crap, when suddenly all the hair stood up on the back of my neck. When I turned around, the seventh elephant was staring me down from the other side of a very flimsy portable electric fence. She was huge this close. Her ears were pinned back against her head, and her trunk dragged on the ground. Sparse hair sprouted from the bony ridge of her brow. Her eyes, they were soulful and brown. She bellowed, and I fell back even though there was a fence between us. She trumpeted again, louder this time, and moved away. Then she stopped after a few steps and turned to look at me. She did the same thing two more times. It was almost as if she was waiting for me to follow. When I didn't move, the elephant returned and reached delicately between the electric lines of the fencing. I could feel hot breath huffing from the end of her trunk. I could smell hay and dust. I held my breath, and she touched my cheek, as gently as a whisper. This time, when she started to move, I followed, keeping the fence between us, until the elephant made a sharp turn and started to walk away from me. She moved into a valley, and the moment before she disappeared from view, she glanced back at me again. In high school, we used to cut across cow pastures as shortcuts. They were protected by electric fences. We'd leap, then grab the wire and soar over. As long as we let go before our feet touched the ground, we wouldn't get a shock. I started to run, hurdling the wire. At the last moment, my shoe dragged on the dirt, and my hand was shocked numb. I fell, rolling in the dust, and then scrambled upright, facing toward the spot where the elephant had disappeared. About 400 yards away, I found the elephant standing over the body of a woman. "Holy fuck," I whispered, and the elephant rumbled. When I took a step forward, her trunk shot out, whacking me on the shoulder and knocking me down. I had no doubt that was a warning. She could have swatted me halfway across the sanctuary if she'd really wanted. "Hey, girl," I said softly, making eye contact. "I can tell you want to take care of her. I want to take care of her, too. You just have to let me get a little closer. I promise she'll be okay." As I kept talking, the elephant's posture relaxed. The ears pinned against her head fluttered forward. Her trunk curled over the woman's chest. With a delicacy I would never have imagined in an animal so big, she lifted her massive feet and stepped away from the body. In that moment, I really got it. I understood why the Metcalfs had started this sanctuary and why Gideon wouldn't blame one of these creatures for killing his relative. I understood why Thomas would try to understand the brains of these animals. There was something I could not put my finger on, not just a complexity or a connection, but an equality, as if we both knew we were on the same side here. I nodded at the elephant. And I swear to God, she nodded back at me. Maybe I was naive. Maybe I was just an idiot. But I knelt beside that elephant, close enough for her to crush me if she wanted to, and felt for the woman's pulse. She had dried blood matting her scalp and her face. Her features were purple and swollen. She was totally unresponsive, and she was alive. "Thank you," I said to the elephant, because it was clear to me, anyway, that she had been protecting this woman. I looked up, but the animal had disappeared, slipping silently into the fringe of trees beyond this little valley. I hauled the body into my arms and started to sprint toward the MCU investigators. In spite of what Thomas Metcalf had said, Alice hadn't run away with his daughter or his precious research. She was right here. Once, when I went on a bender, I had a hallucination that I was playing poker with Santa Claus and a unicorn that kept cheating. Suddenly, the Russian mafia burst into the room and started beating on Saint Nick. I ran away, climbing up the fire escape before they could get me, too. The unicorn was right beside me, and when we got to the roof of the building, he told me to jump off and fly. I came to at that moment because my cell phone rang, and I had one leg over the edge, as if I was freaking Peter Pan. There but for the grace of God, I thought. I poured all the booze in my place down the sink drain that morning. I was sober for 3 days. During that time, a new client asked me to get pictures of her husband, who she thought was cheating on her with another woman. He disappeared for hours at a time on weekends, saying he was going to the hardware store, and never returned with a single purchased item. He had started to erase messages on his cell phone. He seemed, she said, like he wasn't the man she had married. I tracked the guy one Saturday to, of all places, a zoo. He was with a woman, all right, one who happened to be about 4 years old. The girl ran up to the fence at the elephant enclosure. Immediately, I thought of the animals I'd seen at the sanctuary, roaming free through the vast acreage, not cooped up in a little concrete pen. The elephant was rocking back and forth, as if it were moving to music none of us could hear.
"Daddy," the little girl said, "it's dancing."
"I once saw an elephant peel an orange," I said casually, remembering a visit to the sanctuary after the caregiver's death. It had been one of Olive's behaviors. She rolled the tiny fruit under her massive front foot until it split, then delicately unraveled the peel with her trunk. I nodded at the man, my client's husband. I happened to know they didn't have any children. "Cute kid," I said.
"Yeah," he replied. And I could hear the wonder in his voice that comes when you find out you're having a baby, not when your child is 4. Unless, of course, you have only just discovered that you're her dad.
I had to go home and tell my client that her husband wasn't two-timing her with another woman, but that he had a whole life she had not known about. Was it any wonder that night I dreamed of finding Alice Metcalf's unconscious body and of the vow I'd made that elephant, which I never did keep? I promise she'll be okay. And that was when my run of sobriety ended. I can't remember all the details about the 8 hours or so after I found Alice Metcalf, because so much happened in such a short amount of time. She was brought by ambulance to the local hospital, still unconscious. I gave instructions to the paramedics who accompanied her to call us the minute she came to. We asked cops from neighboring towns to help complete a sweep of the elephant sanctuary, because we didn't know if Alice Metcalf's daughter was still out there. At about 9 p.m., we swung by the hospital, only to be told that Alice Metcalf was still out cold. I thought we should arrest Thomas as a person of interest. Donnie said that wasn't possible, since we didn't know if any crime had been committed. He said that we'd have to wait for Alice to wake up and tell us herself what had happened, and if Thomas had anything to do with her head injury or the kid's disappearance or Nevy's death. We were still at the hospital waiting for her to regain consciousness when Gideon called, panicked. 20 minutes later, we accompanied him to the sanctuary enclosure, shining flashlights into the dark, where Thomas Metcalf was standing in his bare feet and bathrobe, trying to secure chains around the front legs of an elephant. She kept trying to rip away from her restraints. A dog was barking and nipping at him, attempting to stop him. Metcalf kicked the dog in the ribs, and it whimpered away on its belly.
It'll only take a few minutes to get the U-0126 into her system.
I don't know what the hell he's doing, Gideon said. But we do not chain elephants here. The elephants were rumbling, an unholy earthquake that shuddered across the ground and up my legs. You've got to get him out of there, Gideon muttered, before the elephant gets hurt.
Or vice versa, I thought.
It took an hour to talk Thomas out of the enclosure. It took another 30 minutes for Gideon to get close enough to the terrified animal to remove the shackles. We handcuffed Metcalf, which seemed awfully fitting, and brought him to a psychiatric hospital 60 miles south of Boone. For a while during the drive, we were out of the range of cell phone coverage, which is why it wasn't until an hour later I got the message that Alice Metcalf was awake. By then, we had been on the job for 16 hours.
Tomorrow, Donnie pronounced. We'll interview her first thing. Neither one of us is going to be any good right now.
And so began the biggest mistake of my life. Sometime between midnight and 6 a.m., Alice signed herself out of Mercy Hospital and disappeared off the face of the earth.
Mr. Stanhope, she says. Virgil Stanhope?
When I open the door, the kid speaks the word like an accusation, as if being named Virgil is equivalent to having an STD. Immediately, all my defenses kick in. I'm not Virgil and haven't been for a long time.
You've got the wrong person.
Didn't you ever wonder what happened to Alice Metcalf?
I peer more closely at her face, which is still kind of blurry thanks to the amount I've drunk. Then I squint. This must be another hallucination.
Go away,
I slur.
Not until you admit that you're the guy who dropped my mother off, unconscious, at a hospital 10 years ago.
Just like that, I'm stone-cold sober, and I know who this is standing before me. Not Alice, and not just a hallucination.
Jenna, you're her daughter.
The light that washes over that girl's face looks like the kind of thing you see in paintings in cathedrals, the sort of art that breaks your heart even as you stare at it.
She told you about me?
Alice Metcalf had not told me anything, of course. She wasn't at the hospital when I went back there the morning after the trampling to take her statement. All the nurse could tell me was that she'd signed her own paperwork for discharge and that she mentioned someone named Jenna. Donnie took that as proof that Gideon's story had been the legitimate one, that Alice Metcalf had run off with her daughter as she'd been hoping to. Given the fact that her husband was a whack job, that seemed like a happy ending. At the time, Donnie had been 2 weeks shy of retirement, and I knew he wanted to clear out the paperwork on his desk, including the caregiver's death at the New England Elephant Sanctuary.
"It was an accident, Virgil," he said emphatically when I pushed him to dig deeper. "Alice Metcalf is not a suspect. She's not even a missing person until someone reports it."
But nobody ever did. And when I tried to, I was stonewalled by Donnie, who told me that if I knew what was good for me, I'd just let this one go. When I argued that he was making the wrong call here, Donnie lowered his voice.
"I'm not the one making it," he said cryptically.
For a decade, there were things about that case that didn't sit right with me. Yet now, 10 years later, here is the proof that Donnie Boylan was right all along.
"Holy shit," I say, rubbing my temples. "I can't believe this."
I let the door fall back so that Jenna walks in, wrinkling her nose at the crumpled fast food wrappers on the floor and the smell of stale smoke. With a shaking hand, I pull a cigarette from my shirt pocket and light up.
"Those things will kill you."
"Not fast enough," I mutter, drawing in for that kick of nicotine. I swear, sometimes that's the only thing that keeps me alive another day. Jenna slaps down a $20 bill.
"Well, try to pull it together for just a little bit longer," she says. "At least long enough for me to hire you."
I laugh.
"Sweetheart, save your piggy bank change. If your dog's missing, put up flyers. If a guy dumped you for a hotter girl,
Stuff your bra and make him jealous. That advice, it's all free, by the way, because that's how I roll. She doesn't blink.
I'm hiring you to finish your job.
What?
You have to find my mother, she says.
There is something I never told anyone about that case. The days after the death at the New England Sanctuary were, as you can imagine, a freaking PR nightmare, with Thomas Metcalf in a drugged stupor at a residential psychiatric treatment facility, and his wife AWOL. The only caregiver left was Gideon. The sanctuary itself was bankrupt and in default. All the cracks in its foundation now laid bare to the public. No food was coming in for the elephants. No more hay. The property was going to be seized by the bank. But in order for that to happen, its residents, all 35,000 pounds of them, needed to be relocated. It's not easy to find a home for 7 elephants. But Gideon had grown up in Tennessee and knew about a place in Hohenwald called the Elephant Sanctuary. They recognized this as an emergency and were willing to do whatever they could for the New Hampshire animals. They agreed to house the elephants in their quarantine barn until a new one could be built for them specifically. That week, a new case got thrown onto my desk. A babysitter, 17 years old, who was responsible for a 6-month-old's brain damage. I immersed myself in trying to get the girl, a cheerleader with blonde hair and a perfect white smile, to admit to shaking the infant. Which is why, on the day of Donnie's retirement party, I was still at my desk when the medical examiner's report on Nevi Rule came through. I knew what it said already. That the caregiver's death was accidental, caused by the trampling of an elephant. But I found myself scrolling through the text, reading the weight of the victim's heart. Brain. Liver. On the last page was a list of the articles found with the body. One of those items was a single strand of red hair. I grabbed the report and ran downstairs, where Donnie was wearing a party hat and blowing out the candles on a cake shaped like an 18th hole. Donnie, I murmured, we have to talk.
Now?
I pulled him into the hallway.
Look!
I shoved the ME's report into his hand and watched him scan the results.
You dragged me out of my own going-away party to tell me what I already know? I've already told you, Verge. Put it to rest.
That hair, I said, the red one. That's not the victim's. She was blonde, which means that there could have been a struggle.
Or that someone reused a body bag.
I'm pretty sure that Alice Metcalf has red hair.
So do 6 million other people in the United States. And even if it does happen to belong to Alice Metcalf, so what? The two women knew each other. Trace evidence would transfer due to their interactions. This would only prove that at some point they were in proximity. That's Forensics 101.
He narrowed his eyes.
I'm going to give you a little advice. No detective wants to be in charge of a town that's on edge. 2 days ago, most of Boone was shitting bricks about crazy rogue elephants that could kill them in their sleep. Now everyone's finally settling down again, since the elephants are leaving. Alice Metcalf is probably in Miami, enrolling her kid in preschool under a fake name. If you start saying this case might not have been accidental, but actually a murder, you're going to create a fresh panic. When you hear hoofbeats, Virgil, chances are it's a horse, not a zebra. People want cops who keep them safe from trouble, not cops who go looking for it where it doesn't exist. You want to make detective? Stop being Superman and be Mary fucking Poppins instead.
He patted me on the back and headed toward the room full of revelers.
What did you mean?
I yelled after him.
When you said it wasn't your call.
Donnie stopped in his tracks, looked into the crowd of celebrating co-workers, and then grabbed my arm and pulled me in the opposite direction, where there would be no chance of us being overheard.
Did you ever wonder why the press didn't go apeshit over this? It's New fucking Hampshire. Nothing ever happens here. Anything that smells like potential homicide is usually as irresistible as crack.
Unless, he said quietly, people far more powerful than you or me inform them to stop digging.
Back then, I still believed in justice,
in the system. You're telling me the chief's okay with that?
It's an election year, Verge. The governor can't win a second term on a zero-crime platform if the public thinks there's still a murderer wandering around Boone. He sighed. That governor is the same guy who increased the budget for public safety so you could get hired in the first place. So you could protect the community without having to choose between a cost of living raise and a Kevlar vest.
He looked directly at me.
Suddenly, doing the right thing isn't so black and white, is it?
I watched Donnie walk away, but I never joined him at the party. Instead, I returned to my desk and worked the last page of the Emmy's report free from its staple. Folding it into quarters, I slipped the page into the pocket of my jacket. I put the rest of the Emmy's report in the closed case file of Nevi Rule, and instead pored over the evidence I had for the shaken baby. 2 days later, Donnie officially retired, and I got the teenage cheerleader to confess. The elephants, I heard, adapted well in Tennessee. The sanctuary land was sold, half to the state in conservation and half to a developer. After all the debts were paid, the remaining funds were managed by a lawyer to pay for the residential care of Thomas Metcalf. His wife never came back to claim any of it. 6 months afterward, I was promoted to detective. The morning of the ceremony, I dressed in my one good suit and took, from my nightstand drawer, the folded page of the ME's report. I tucked this into my breast pocket. I needed to remind myself that I was no hero.
"She's missing again?" I ask.
"What do you mean, again?" Jenna answers. She sits down in the chair across from my desk and folds her legs, Indian style. That, at least, cuts through the fog in my brain. I stub my cigarette out in a stale cup of coffee.
"Didn't she run off with you?"
"I'm going to say no," Jenna says, "since I haven't seen her in 10 years.
"Wait," I shake my head.
"What?"
"You were one of the last people to see my mother alive,"
Jenna explains.
"You dropped her off at the hospital, and then when she disappeared, you didn't even do what any policeman with half a brain would do. Go after her."
"I had no reason to go after her. She signed herself out of the hospital. Adults do that every day."
"She had a head injury.
The hospital wouldn't have flagged it as long as they felt she was safe to be checking out, or else it would have been a HIPAA violation. Since they didn't seem to have a problem with her leaving, and since we never heard otherwise, we assumed that she was okay and that she was running off with you."
"Then how come you never charged her with kidnapping?"
I shrug. "Your father never officially reported her missing."
"I guess he was too busy being electrocuted as part of his therapy."
"If you weren't with your mother, who's been taking care of you all this time?"
"My grandmother."
So that was where Alice had stashed the baby. "And why didn't she report your mother's disappearance?" The girl's cheeks flush.
"I was too young to remember, but she says she went to the police station the week after my mom disappeared. I guess nothing ever came of it."
Was that true? I couldn't remember anyone formally lodging a missing persons complaint about Alice Metcalf. But then maybe the woman hadn't seen me. Maybe she'd seen Donnie instead. It wouldn't have surprised me if Alice Metcalf's mother had been dismissed when she asked for help, or if Donnie had tossed the paperwork intentionally so that I wouldn't stumble across it, because he knew I'd want to follow up and drag out the case.
"The point is," Jenna says, "you should have tried to find her, and you didn't. So you owe me now."
"What makes you so sure she can be found?"
"She's not dead."
Jenna looks me in the eye.
"I think I'd know it. Feel it."
If I had a Ben Franklin for every time I'd heard that from someone who was hoping for good news in a missing persons case, only to have the remains turn up, well, I'd be drinking Macallan whiskey, not J.D. But instead, I say, "Is it possible she didn't come back because she didn't want to? A lot of people reinvent themselves."
"Like you?"
she asks, staring right at me.
"Victor?"
"Okay, yeah.
I admit. If your life sucks completely, sometimes it's easier to start over.
My mom did not just decide to become someone else, she insists. She liked who she was, and she wouldn't have left me behind.
I did not know Alice Metcalf, but I know there are two ways to live. Jenna's way, where you hang on to what you have in a death grip so you don't lose it, or my way, where you walk away from everything and everyone that matters before they can leave you behind. Either way, you're bound to be disappointed. It's possible that Alice knew her marriage was a mess, that it was only a matter of time before she screwed up her kid, too. Maybe like me, she cut bait before her life got even worse. I spear a hand through my hair. Look, no one wants to hear that maybe she's the reason her mother flew the coop. But my advice to you is to put this behind you. File it away in the drawer that's saved for all the other crap that isn't fair, like how the Kardashians are famous, and how good-looking people get served faster at restaurants, and how a kid who can't skate to save his life winds up on the varsity hockey team because his dad is the coach. Jenna nods, but says,
What if I told you I had proof that she didn't leave of her own free will?
You can give the detective shield back, but you can't always get rid of the instincts. All the hair on my forearms stands up.
What do you mean?
The kid reaches into her backpack and pulls out a wallet. A muddy, faded, cracked leather wallet that she hands to me.
I hired a psychic and we found this.
You've got to be kidding, I say, my hangover roaring back full force. A psychic?
Well, before you say she's a hack, she found something that your whole team of crime scene investigators never managed to find.
She watches me open the clasp of the wallet and sort through the credit cards and driver's license.
It was up in a tree on the sanctuary property, Jenna says, close to where my mom was found unconscious.
How do you know where she was found unconscious? I ask sharply.
Serenity told me, the psychic.
Oh, well, good. Because I thought maybe you had a less reliable source.
Anyway,
she continues, ignoring me,
it was buried under a lot of stuff. Birds had been making nests up in there for a while.
She takes it out of my hands and slips from the cracked plastic photo insert the only picture still even remotely visible. It's bleached and faded and wrinkled, but even I can see the gummy mouth of a smiling baby.
That's me, Jenna says. If you were going to run away from a child forever, wouldn't you at least keep a picture?
I stopped trying to figure out why humans do what they do a long time ago. As for the wallet, it doesn't prove anything. She could have dropped it while she was running.
And it magically flew up 15 feet into a tree?
Jenna shakes her head.
Who put it up there? And why?
Immediately I think, Gideon Cartwright. I don't have any reason to suspect the man. I have no idea why his name pops into my head. As far as I know, he went to Tennessee with those elephants and lived there happily ever after. Then again, it was Gideon who Alice allegedly confided in about her failed marriage. And it was Gideon whose mother-in-law was killed. Which brings me to my next thought. What if the death of Nevi Rule had not been an accident, as Donnie Boylan had pushed me to believe? What if Alice had been the one to kill Nevi, had stashed her own wallet in the tree to make it look like she was the victim of foul play, and then run away before she could be named as a suspect? I look across my desk at Jenna. Be careful what you wish for, sweetheart. If I still had a conscience, I might feel a twinge about agreeing to help a kid find her mother, considering that it might involve pinning a homicide on the woman. But then again, I can play my cards close to my chest and let the girl believe this is just about finding a missing person, not a possible murderer. Besides, maybe I'm doing her a favor. I know what loose ends can do to a soul. The sooner she knows the truth, whatever it is, the sooner she can get on with her future. I hold out my hand. Ms. Metcalf, I say, you've got yourself a private eye.
Alice. I have studied memory extensively, and the best analogy I've found to explain its mechanics is this. Think of the brain as the central office of your body. Every experience you have on any given day, then, is a folder being dropped on a desk to be filed away for future reference. The administrative assistant who comes in at night while you're asleep to clear that logjam in her inbox is the part of the brain called the hippocampus. The hippocampus takes all these folders and files them in places that make sense. This experience is a fight with your husband? Great, let's put it with a few more of those from last year. This experience is a memory of a fireworks display? Cross-reference it with a 4th of July party you attended a while back. She tries to place each memory where there are as many related incidents as possible, because that is what makes them easier to retrieve. Sometimes, though, you simply cannot remember an experience. Let's say you go to a baseball game, and someone tells you later that two rows behind you there was a woman sobbing in a yellow dress, but you have absolutely no recollection of her. There are only two scenarios in which this is possible. Either the incident was never dropped off for filing, you were focused instead on the batter and didn't pay attention to the crying woman, or the hippocampus screwed up and coded that memory in a place it should not be. That sad woman gets linked to your nursery school teacher, who also used to wear a yellow dress, which is a place you'd never find it. You know how sometimes you have a dream about someone from your past who you barely remember and whose name you couldn't recall if your life depended on it? It means that you accessed that path serendipitously and found a bit of buried treasure. Things you do routinely, things that get consolidated repeatedly by that hippocampus, form nice big connections. Taxi drivers in London have been proven to have very large hippocampi because they have to process so much spatial information. We don't know, however, if they are born with naturally large hippocampi, or if the organ grows as it is put to the test, like a muscle being exercised. There are also some people who cannot forget. People with PTSD may have smaller hippocampi than ordinary people. Some scientists believe that corticoids, stress hormones, can atrophy the hippocampus and cause memory disruptions. Elephants, on the other hand, have enlarged hippocampi. You hear anecdotally that an elephant never forgets, and I do believe this is true. Up in Kenya, at Amboseli, researchers have done playbacks of long-distance contact calls in an experiment that suggests adult female elephants can recognize more than 100 individuals. When the calls were from a herd with which they had associated, the elephants being tested responded with their own contact calls. When the vocalizations were from an unfamiliar herd, they bunched and backed away. There was one unusual response in this experiment. During its course, one of the older female elephants that had been recorded died. They played back her contact call 3 months after her death and again at 23 months post-mortem. In both instances, her family responded with their own contact calls and approached the speaker, which suggests not just processing or memory, but abstract thought. Not only did the family of the lost elephant remember her voice, but for just a moment as they approached that speaker, I bet they hoped to find her. As a female elephant gets older, her memory improves. After all, her family relies on her for information. She is the walking archive that makes the decisions for the herd. Is it dangerous here? Where are we going to eat? Where are we going to drink? How are we going to find water? A matriarch might know migratory routes that have gone unused for the lifespan of the entire herd, including herself, yet somehow have been passed down and encoded into a recollection. But my favorite story about elephant memory comes from Polanisburg, where I did some of my doctoral work. In the 90s, to control the South African elephant population, there had been massive culling in which park rangers shot adults within the herds and translocated the babies to places where there was a need for elephants. Unfortunately, the juveniles were traumatized and didn't behave the way they were supposed to. In Polonisburg, a group of translocated young elephants didn't know how to function as a legitimate herd. They needed matriarchs, someone to guide them. And so, an American trainer named Randall Moore brought to Polonisburg two adult female elephants that years ago had been sent to the United States after being orphaned during a cull in the Kruger National Park. The young elephants immediately took to Notch and Felicia, the names we gave these surrogate mothers. Two herds formed, and 12 years passed. And then, in a tragic accident, Felicia was bitten by a hippo. The bush vet needed to clean and dress the wound repeatedly while it healed, but he couldn't anesthetize Felicia each time. You can only dart an elephant 3 times a month, or the M99 drug builds up too much in its system. Felicia's health was at risk, and if she died, her herd would find itself in jeopardy once again. That's when we thought about elephant memory. The trainer who'd worked with these two females more than a decade ago had not seen them since they were released into the reserve. Randall was happy to come to Polonisburg to help. We tracked the two herds, which at this point had merged because of the injury of the older female.
"There are my girls,"
Randall said, delighted, as the jeep shuddered to a halt in front of the herd.
"Owala," he called. "Durga."
To us, these elephants were Felicia and Notch, but both of the stately ladies turned at the sound of Randall's voice, and he did what no one did with the fragile, skittish Polonisburg herd. He got out of the jeep and started walking toward them. "Now look, I've worked in the wild with elephants for 12 years. There are some herds you can approach on foot, because they're used to researchers and their vehicles, and they trust us. And even so, it's not something I would do without carefully thinking it through. But this was not a herd that was familiar with humans. This was not even a stable herd. In fact, the younger elephants immediately stampeded away from Randall, identifying him as one of those two-legged beasts that had killed their own mothers. The two matriarchs, however, came closer. Durga, Notch, approached Randall. She stuck her trunk out and gently snaked it around his arm. Then she glanced back at her nervous, young, adoptive charges, still snorting and huffing on the ridge of the hill. She turned to Randall again, trumpeted once, and ran off with her babies. Randall let her go, then turned to the other matriarch and said softly, "Owala, kneel." The elephant we called Felicia walked forward, knelt down, and let Randall climb on her back. Although she'd had no direct contact with people in 12 years, she remembered not only this individual man as her trainer, but all the commands he had taught her. Without being given any anesthetic, she allowed Randall to direct her to stay, lift her leg, turn. Commands that made it possible for the bush vet to scrape away the pus from the infected area, clean the wound, and give her an injection of antibiotics. Long after her infection healed, long after Randall had returned to training circus animals, Felicia went back to leading her patchwork family in Polonisburg. To any researcher, to anyone at all, she was a wild elephant. But somewhere, somehow, she remembered who she used to be, too.
Jenna. There's another recollection I have of my mother that ties to a conversation scrawled in her journal. It's a single handwritten page, scraps of dialogue that for some reason she didn't ever want to forget. Maybe that's why I remember it so clearly, too. Why I can flesh out what she has written as if it is a movie playing out before me. She's lying on the ground, her head in my father's lap. They are talking as I yank the heads off wild daisies. I'm not paying attention, but part of my brain must be, recording everything, so that even now I can hear the gossip of mosquitoes and the words my parents toss back and forth. Their voices rise and fall and swoop like the tail of a kite. Him.
You have to admit, Alice, there are certain animals that know there's one perfect mate.
Her.
Crap. Complete and utter crap. Prove to me that monogamy exists in the natural world without an environmental influence.
Him.
Swans.
Her. Too easy, and not true. A quarter of black swans cheat on their mates. Him.
Wolves.
Her. They've been known to mate with another wolf if their mate is kicked out of the pack or isn't able to breed. That's circumstance, not true love.
Him. I should have known better than to fall for a scientist. Your idea of a Valentine's heart probably has an aorta.
Her. Is it a crime to be biologically relevant? She sits up and pins him onto the ground, so that now he is lying beneath her, and her hair swings over his face. It looks like they're fighting, but they're both smiling.
Her.
Do you know a vulture caught cheating on his mate will be attacked by others?
Him. Is that supposed to scare me?
Her. I'm just saying.
Him. Gibbons.
Her. Oh, come on. Everyone knows Gibbons are unfaithful. He rolls so that now he is on top looking down at her.
Him.
Prairie voles.
Her.
Only because of the oxytocin and vasopressin released in their brains, it's not love, it's chemical commitment. Slowly she grins.
Her.
You know, now that I think about it, there is one species that's completely monogamous. The male anglerfish, which is a tenth the size of the girl of his dreams, follows her scent, bites her, and hangs on until his skin fuses into hers and her body absorbs his. They mate for life. But it's a really short life if you're the guy in the relationship.
Him.
I'd fuse to you. He kisses her.
Him.
Right at the lips. When they laugh, it sounds like confetti.
Her.
Fine. If it shuts you up about this once and for all. They stop talking for a little while. I hold my palm over the ground. I've seen Mora lift her rear foot inches above the dirt, moving it slowly back and forth like she's rolling it over an invisible stone. My mother says that she can hear the other elephants when she does that, that they talk even when we don't hear them. I wonder if that's what my parents are doing now, speaking without sound. When my father's voice comes again, it sounds like the string on a guitar that is pulled so tight. You can't tell if it is music or crying.
Him. Do you know how a penguin picks his mate? He finds a perfect pebble and gives it to the female he has his eye on.
He hands my mother a small stone. Her hand closes around it. Most of my mother's journals from her time in Botswana are stuffed chock full of data. The names and movements of elephant families trekking across the Tule block. Dates when males came into must and females calved. Hourly logs of the behavior of animals who do not care or do not know that they are being watched. I read each entry, but instead of seeing elephants, I picture the hand that wrote the notes. Was there a cramp in her fingers? A callus where the pencil pressed too hard against the skin? I put together the clues of my mother the same way she shuffled and reshuffled the observations of her elephants, trying to make a bigger picture from the smallest details. I wonder if it was just as frustrating for her to get glimpses, but never the whole mystery revealed. I guess a scientist's job is to fill in the gaps. Me, though, I look at a puzzle and can only see the single missing piece. I'm starting to think Virgil feels the same way. And I have to admit, I don't exactly know what that says about either of us. When he says he'll take the job, I don't quite trust him. It's hard to believe a guy who's so hungover that he looks like he's having a stroke when he tries to put on his jacket. I figure my best bet is to make sure that he remembers this conversation, which means getting him out of his office and sober. Why don't we talk over some coffee? I suggest. I passed a diner on my way here. He grabs his car keys, but that's not happening. You're drunk, I say. I'm driving. He shrugs, going along with it until we walk out the entryway of the building, and he sees me unlock my bike. What the fuck is that? If you don't know, you're drunker than I thought, I say, and I climb on the seat. When you said you'd drive, Virgil mutters, I assumed you had a car. I'm 13, I point out and gesture at the handlebars. Are you kidding? What is this, 1972? You can run alongside if you want, I say. But with the headache I'm guessing you have, I'd take door number one instead. Which is how we wind up arriving at the diner, with Virgil Stanhope sitting on my mountain bike, his legs spread, while I stand up between them and pedal. We seat ourselves at a booth. How come there weren't any flyers? I say. Huh? Flyers, with my mom's face on them. How come no one set up a command center at a crappy Holiday Inn conference room and manned a telephone bank for tips?
I told you already, Virgil replies. She was never a missing person.
I just stare at him.
Okay, correction. If your grandmother actually filed a missing persons report, it got lost in the shuffle.
You're saying I grew up without a mother because of human error?
I'm saying I did my job. Someone else didn't do theirs.
He looks at me over the edge of his mug.
I was called into the elephant sanctuary because there was a dead body there. It was ruled an accident. Case closed. When you're a cop, you don't try to make messes. You just clean up the spills.
So you're basically admitting you were too lazy to care that one of your witnesses for the case had disappeared. He scowls.
No. I was making the assumption that your mother left of her own free will, or else I would have heard otherwise. I assumed she was with you.
Virgil narrows his eyes.
Where were you when your mother was found by the cops?
I don't know. Sometimes she left me with Nevi during the day, but not at night. I just remember eventually being with my grandma at her place.
Well, I should start by talking to her.
I shake my head immediately. No way! She'd kill me if she knew I was doing this.
Doesn't she want to know what happened to her daughter?
It's complicated, I say. I think maybe it hurts her too much to keep dragging it up. She's from that generation that just puts on a stiff upper lip or whatever, and soldiers through the bad stuff and pretends it never happened. Whenever I used to cry for my mom, my grandma tried to distract me, with food or a toy or with Gertie, my dog. And then one day when I asked, she said,
She's gone.
But the way she said it sounded like a knife. So I learned pretty fast to stop asking.
What took you so long to come forward? 10 years isn't just a cold case, it's a freaking Arctic wasteland.
A waitress walks by, and I signal to her, trying to get her attention, since Virgil needs coffee if he's going to be of any use to me. She doesn't see me at all. That's what it's like to be a kid, I say. No one takes you seriously. People look right through you. Even if I'd been able to figure out where to go when I was 8 or 10, even if I'd managed to get myself to the police station, even if you hadn't left your job and the sergeant at the front desk told you a kid wanted to get you to reopen a closed case, what would you have done? Would you have let me stand in front of your desk, talking while you smiled and nodded and didn't pay attention? Or told your cop buddies about the girl who showed up and wanted to play detective? Another waitress bustles out of the kitchen, and a wedge of noises, frying, banging, clattering, squawks through the swinging door. This one, at least, comes right toward us.
What can I get you?
She asks. Coffee, I say. A whole pot. She looks at Virgil, snorts, and retreats. It's like that old saying, I tell him. If no one hears you, are you even talking? The waitress brings us 2 cups of coffee. Virgil hands me the sugar, even though I haven't asked for it. I meet his gaze, and for a moment, I can see through the haze of the booze, and I'm not sure if I'm comforted by what I see, or a little scared.
I'm listening now, he says.
The list of what I remember about my mother is embarrassingly short. There's that moment where she fed me cotton candy. Ooh, sweetie. Ooh, sweetie. There's the conversation about mating for life. There's a glimpse I have of her laughing as Maura reaches her trunk over a fence and pulls her hair free from its ponytail. My mother's hair is red. Not strawberry blonde and not orange, but the color of someone who's burning up inside. Okay, so maybe the reason I remember this incident is because I've seen a photo someone snapped at that very moment. But the smell of her hair, like cinnamon sugar, that's a real memory that has nothing to do with a picture. Sometimes when I really miss her, I eat French toast, just so that I can close my eyes and breathe in. My mother's voice when she was upset wobbled like a heat mirage of asphalt in the summer. And she would hug me and tell me it was going to be all right, even though she had been the one to cry. Sometimes I would wake up in the middle of the night and find her watching me sleep. She never wore rings, but she had a necklace that she never took off. She used to sing in the shower. She took me out on the ATV with her to watch the elephants, even though my father thought it was too dangerous for me to be in the enclosures. I rode on her lap, and she would lean down and whisper in my ear, "This can be our secret." We had matching pink sneakers. She knew how to fold a dollar bill into an elephant. Instead of reading me books at night, she told me stories. How she had seen an elephant free a baby rhino stuck in the mud. How a little girl whose best friend was an orphaned elephant left her family home to go to university and returned years later to have that now fully grown elephant wrap a trunk around her and pull her close. I remember my mother sketching, drawing the giant G-clefs of elephant ears, which she would then mark with notches or tears to help her identify the individual. She would list behaviors. Sarah reaches for and removes plastic bag from Lily's tusk. Given that vegetation is routinely carried in tusks, this suggests awareness of foreign object and subsequent cooperative removal. Even something as soft as empathy would be given the most academic treatment. It was part of being taken seriously in her field, not to anthropomorphize elephants, but to study their behavior clinically, and from that, to extrapolate the facts. Me, I look at the facts I remember about my mother, and I guess at her behavior. I do the opposite of what a scientist should do. I can't help but think, if my mother met me now, would she be disappointed? Virgil turns my mother's wallet over in his hands. It is so fragile that the leather starts to crumble beneath his fingers. I see that, and I feel a stab in my chest, as if I'm losing her all over again.
This doesn't necessarily mean that your mother was a victim of foul play, Virgil says. She could have lost the wallet the night she wound up unconscious.
I fold my hands on the table. Look, I know what you think, that she's the one who put the wallet up in the tree so she could disappear, but it's pretty hard to climb a tree and hide a wallet when you're knocked out cold.
If that's what she was doing, why didn't she leave it someplace it might actually be found?
And then what? Smash herself in the head with a rock? If she really wanted to disappear, why wouldn't she have just run? Virgil hesitates.
There might have been extenuating circumstances.
Like?
Your mother wasn't the only one injured that night, you know.
Suddenly, I understand what he's saying. My mother may have been trying to make herself look like she was a victim, when in reality, she was the perp. My mouth goes dry. Of all the potential personas I've given my mother over the past decade, murderer wasn't one of them. If you really thought my mother was a killer, why didn't you go after her when she disappeared? His mouth opens and closes around empty air. Bam, I think.
The D death was ruled an accident,
he says.
But we did find a red hair at the scene.
That's like saying you found a bimbo on The Bachelor. My mom wasn't the only redhead in Boone, New Hampshire.
We found the hair inside the body bag of the deceased.
So, A, that's gross. And B, big deal. I watch Law & Order SVU. It just means that they had contact with each other. That probably happened 10 times a day.
Or it could mean that hair got transferred during a physical altercation.
How did Nevi Rule die? I demand. Did the medical examiner say the cause of death was homicide? He shakes his head.
He ruled it an accident, caused by blunt force trauma due to trampling.
I may not remember a lot about my mom, but I know she wasn't 5,000 pounds, I say. So let me toss out a different scenario. What if Nevi went after her? And one of the elephants saw the whole thing and retaliated.
They do that?
I wasn't sure, but I remembered reading in my mother's journals about elephants that held grudges, that might wait years to even the score against someone who'd harmed them or someone they cared about.
Besides,
Virgil said,
you just told me that your mother left you in Nevi Rule's care. I doubt she would have let Nevi babysit if she thought the woman was dangerous.
I doubt my mom would have let Nevi babysit if she also wanted to murder her, I point out. My mom didn't kill her. It just doesn't add up. There were a dozen cops swarming around that night. Based on pure probability, chances are one of them was a redhead. You don't know if that hair belongs to my mother. Virgil nods.
But I know how to find out.
Here's one more thing I remember. Inside, my parents are fighting.
How can you do that?
My father accuses.
Make this all about you!
I'm sitting on the floor, crying, but no one seems to hear me. I won't move because moving is what led to all the shouting. Instead of staying on the blanket and playing with the toys my mother had brought into the elephant enclosure, I had chased a yellow butterfly as it flew a dotted line across the sky. My mother had her back to me. She was recording her observations. And just then, my father had driven by and had seen me heading downhill where the butterfly went and where elephants happened to be standing.
This is the sanctuary, not the wild,
my mother says.
It's not like she got between a mother and a calf. They're used to people.
My father yells back.
They are not used to toddlers!
Suddenly, a pair of warm arms closes around me. She smells of powder and limes, and her lap is the softest place I know. They're mad, I whisper. They're scared, she corrects. It sounds the same. Then she starts to sing close to my ear, so that her voice is the only one I hear. Virgil has a plan, but the place he wants to go is too far away for me to bike, and I'm still not getting in a car with him. As we walk out of the diner, I agree to meet him at his office the next morning. The sun swinging low, using a cloud as a hammock. How do I know you won't be blitzed tomorrow, too? I ask.
Bring a breathalyzer,
Virgil suggests dryly.
I'll see you at 11.
11's not the morning.
It is for me,
he replies, and he starts walking down the road toward his office. By the time I get back home, my grandmother is draining carrots in a colander. Gertie, curled up in front of the refrigerator, beats her tail twice on the floor, but that's all the hello I'm getting. When I was little, my dog used to practically knock me down if I came back after a trip to the bathroom. That's how happy she was to see me again. I wonder if, as you get older, you stop missing people so fiercely. Maybe growing up is just focusing on what you've got instead of what you don't. There's a sound like footsteps overhead. When I was little, I was sure my grandmother's house was haunted. I was always hearing stuff like that. My grandmother assured me it was rusty pipes or the house settling. I used to wonder how something made of brick and mortar could settle, when I seemed incapable of doing just that.
So,
my grandmother says,
how was he?
For a second I freeze, wondering if she's been having me followed.